at that chaos. While pondering this new idea, I heard the front door open. Mr. Bates came out, and with him was a nurse. After she had seen him mount his horse and depart, she was about to close the door, but I ran up to her. "How is Helen Burns?"
"Very poorly," was the answer.
"Is it her Mr. Bates has been to see?"
"Yes."
"And what does he say about her?"
"He says she'll not be here long."
This phrase, uttered in my hearing yesterday, would have only conveyed the notion that she was about to be removed to Northumberland, to her own home. I should not have suspected that it meant she was dying, but I knew instantly now. It opened clear on my comprehension that Helen Burns was numbering her last days in this world, and that she was going to be taken to the region of spirits, if such region there were. I experienced a shock of horror, then a strong thrill of grief, then a desire, a necessity to see her. And I asked in what room she lay.
"She is in Miss Temple's room," said the nurse.
"May I go up and speak to her?"
"Oh, no, child. It is not likely. And now it is time for you to come in. You'll catch the fever if you stop out when the dew is falling."
The nurse closed the front door. I went in by the side entrance which led to the schoolroom. I was just in time. It was 9 o'clock, and Miss Miller was calling the pupils to go to bed. It might be 2 hours later, probably near 11, when I, not having been able to fall asleep and deeming from the perfect silence of the dormitory that my companions were all wrapped in profound repose, rose softly, put on my frock over my nightdress and, without shoes, crept from the apartment and set off in quest of Miss Temple's room. It was quite at the other end of the house, but I knew my way, and the light of the unclouded summer moon, entering here and there at passage windows, enabled me to find it without difficulty. An odour of camphor and burnt vinegar warned me when I came near the fever room, and I passed its door quickly, fearful lest the nurse who sat up all night should hear me. I dreaded being discovered and sent back, for I must see Helen. I must embrace her before she died. I must give her one last kiss, exchange with her one last word. Having descended a staircase, traversed a portion of the house below, and succeeded in opening and shutting without noise 2 doors, I reached another flight of steps. These I mounted, and then just opposite to me was Miss Temple's room. A light shone through the keyhole and from under the door. A profound stillness pervaded the vicinity. Coming near, I found the door slightly ajar, probably to admit some fresh air into the close abode of sickness. Indisposed to hesitate, and full of impatient impulses, soul and senses quivering with keen throes, I put it back and looked in. My eyes sought Helen and feared to find death. Close by Miss Temple's bed, and half covered with its white curtains, there stood a little crib. I saw the outline of a form under the clothes, but the face was hid by the hangings. The nurse I had spoken to in the garden sat in an easy chair asleep. An unsnuffed candle burnt dimly on the table. Miss Temple was not to be seen. I knew afterwards that she had been called to a delirious patient in the fever room. I advanced, then paused by the crib side. My hand was on the curtain, but I preferred speaking before I withdrew it. I still recoiled at the dread of seeing a corpse. "Helen," I whispered softly, "are you awake?" She stirred herself, put back the curtain, and I saw her face, pale, wasted, but quite composed. She looked so little changed that my fear was instantly dissipated.
"Can it be you, Jane?"
she asked in her own gentle voice. "Oh," I thought, "she's not going to die. They're mistaken. She could not speak and look so calmly if she were." I got onto her crib and kissed her. Her forehead was cold, and her cheek both cold and thin, and so were her hand and wrist, but she smiled as of old.
"Why are you come here, Jane? It is past 11 o'clock.
I heard it strike some minutes since." "I came to see you, Helen. I heard you were very ill, and I could not sleep till I had spoken to you."
"You came to bid me goodbye, then. You're just in time, probably.
Are you going somewhere, Helen? Are you going home?"
"Yes, to my long home. My last home."
No, Helen. I stopped, distressed. While I tried to devour my tears, a fit of coughing seized Helen. It did not, however, wake the nurse. When it was over, she lay some minutes exhausted. Then she whispered,
"Jane, your little feet are bare. Lie down and cover yourself with my quilt."
I did so. She put her arm over me, and I nestled close to her. After a long silence, she resumed, still whispering,
"I am very happy, Jane. And when you hear that I am dead, you must be sure and not grieve. There is nothing to grieve about. We must all die one day, and the illness which is removing me is not painful. It is gentle and gradual. My mind is at rest. I leave no one to regret me much. I have only a father, and he is lately married and will not miss me. By dying young, I shall escape great sufferings. I had not qualities or talents to make my way very well in the world. I should have been continually at fault. But where are you going to, Helen? Can you see? Do you know? I believe. I have faith. I am going to God. Where is God? What is God? My Maker and yours. You will never destroy what he created. I rely implicitly on his power and confide wholly in his goodness. I count the hours till that eventful one arrives which shall restore me to him, reveal him to me.
You are sure then, Helen, that there is such a place as heaven, and that our souls can get to it when we die?
I am sure there is a future state. I believe God is good. I can resign my immortal part to him without any misgiving. God is my father. God is my friend. I love him. I believe he loves me.
And shall I see you again, Helen, when I die?
You will come to the same region of happiness, be received by the same mighty universal parent, no doubt, dear Jane. Again I questioned, but this time only in thought. Where is that region? Does it exist? And I clasped my arms closer round Helen. She seemed dearer to me than ever. I felt as if I could not let her go. I lay with my face hidden on her neck. Presently she said, in the sweetest tone,
"How comfortable I am.
That last fit of coughing has tired me a little. I feel as if I could sleep. But don't leave me, Jane. I like to have you near me.
I'll stay with you, dear Helen. No one shall take me away.
Are you warm, darling?"
"Yes."
"Good night, Jane."
"Good night, Helen."
She kissed me, and I her, and we both soon slumbered. When I awoke, it was day. An unusual movement roused me. I looked up. I was in somebody's arms. The nurse held me. She was carrying me through the passage back to the dormitory. I was not reprimanded for leaving my bed. People had something else to think about. No explanation was afforded then to my many questions. But a day or two afterwards I learned that Miss Temple, on returning to her own room at dawn, had found me laid in the little crib, my face against Helen Byrne's shoulder, my arms round her neck. I was asleep, and Helen was dead. Her grave is in Brocklebridge churchyard. For 15 years after her death it was only covered by a grassy mound. But now, a grey marble tablet marks the spot, inscribed with her name and the word Resurgam. Chapter 10. Hitherto I have recorded in detail the events of my insignificant existence. To the first 10 years of my life I have given almost as many chapters. But this is not to be a regular autobiography. I am only bound to invoke memory where I know her responses will possess some degree of interest. Therefore, I now pass a space of 8 years, almost in silence. A few lines only are necessary to keep up the links of connection. When the typhus fever had fulfilled its mission of devastation at Lowood, it gradually disappeared from thence, but not till its virulence and the number of its victims had drawn public attention on the school. Inquiry was made into the origin of the scourge, and by degrees various facts came out which excited public indignation in a high degree. The unhealthy nature of the site, the quantity and quality of the children's food, the brackish, fetid water used in its preparation, the pupils' wretched clothing and accommodations, all these things were discovered, and the discovery produced a result mortifying to Mr. Brocklehurst, but beneficial to the institution. Several wealthy and benevolent individuals in the county subscribed largely for the erection of a more convenient building in a better situation. New regulations were made. Improvements in diet and clothing introduced. The funds of the school were entrusted to the management of a committee. Mr. Brocklehurst, who, from his wealth and family connections, could not be overlooked, still retained the post of treasurer. But he was aided in the discharge of his duties by gentlemen of rather more enlarged and sympathizing minds. His office of inspector, too, was shared by those who knew how to combine reason with strictness, comfort with economy, compassion with uprightness. The school, thus improved, became in time a truly useful and noble institution. I remained an inmate of its walls, after its regeneration, for 8 years, 6 as pupil and 2 as teacher, and in both capacities I bear my testimony to its value and importance. During these 8 years my life was uniform, but not unhappy, because it was not inactive. I had the means of an excellent education placed within my reach, a fondness for some of my studies and a desire to excel in all, together with a great delight in pleasing my teachers, especially such as I loved, urged me on. I availed myself fully of the advantages offered me. In time I rose to be the first girl of the first class. Then I was invested with the office of teacher, which I discharged with zeal for 2 years, but at the end of that time I altered. Miss Temple, through all changes, had thus far continued superintendent of the seminary. To her instruction I owed the best part of my acquirements. Her friendship and society had been my continual solace. She had stood me in the stead of mother, governess, and latterly companion. At this period she married, removed with her husband, a clergyman, an excellent man, almost worthy of such a wife, to a distant county, and consequently was lost to me. From the day she left I was no longer the same. With her was gone every settled feeling, every association that had made Lowood in some degree a home to me. I had imbibed from her something of her nature and much of her habits, more harmonious thoughts. What seemed better regulated feelings had become the inmates of my mind. I had given in allegiance to duty and order. I was quiet. I believed I was content. To the eyes of others, usually even to my own, I appeared a disciplined and subdued character. But destiny, in the shape of the Reverend Mr. Naismith, came between me and Miss Temple. I saw her in her travelling dress step into a post-chaise shortly after the marriage ceremony. I watched the chaise mount the hill and disappear beyond its brow, and then retire to my own room, and there spent in solitude the greatest part of the half-holiday granted in honour of the occasion. I walked about the chamber most of the time. I imagined myself only to be regretting my loss, and thinking how to repair it. But when my reflections were concluded, and I looked up and found that the afternoon was gone, and evening far advanced, another discovery dawned on me, namely, that in the interval I had undergone a transforming process. That my mind had put off all it had borrowed from Miss Temple, or rather, that she had taken with her the serene atmosphere I had been breathing in her vicinity, and that now I was left in my natural element, and beginning to feel the stirring of old emotions. It did not seem as if a prop were withdrawn, but rather as if a motive were gone. It was not the power to be tranquil which had failed me, but the reason for tranquillity was no more. My world had for some years been in Lowood. My experience had been of its rules and systems. Now I remembered that the real world was wide, and that a varied field of hopes and fears, of sensations and excitements, awaited those who had courage to go forth into its expanse, to seek real knowledge of life amidst its perils. I went to my window, opened it, and looked out. There were the two wings of the building. There was the garden. There were the skirts of Lowood. There was the hilly horizon. My eye passed all other objects to rest on those most remote, the blue peaks. It was those I longed to surmount. All within their boundary of rock and heath seemed prison ground, exile limits. I traced the white road winding round the base of one mountain and vanishing in a gorge between two. How I longed to follow it farther. I recalled the time when I had travelled that very road in a coach. I remembered descending that hill at twilight. An age seemed to have elapsed since the day which brought me first to Lowood, and I had never quitted it since. My vacations had all been spent at school. Mrs. Reed had never sent for me to Gateshead. Neither she nor any of her family had ever been to visit me. I had had no communication by letter or message with the outer world. School rules, school duties, school habits and notions, and voices, and faces, and phrases, and costumes, and preferences, and antipathies. Such was what I knew of existence. And now I felt that it was not enough. I tired of the routine of 8 years in one afternoon. I desired liberty. For liberty I gasped. For liberty I uttered a prayer. It seemed scattered on the wind, then faintly blowing. I abandoned it and framed a humbler supplication. For change. Stimulus. That petition, too, seemed swept off into vague space. Then, I cried, half desperate, grant me at least a new servitude. Here a bell, ringing the hour of supper, called me downstairs. I was not free to resume the interrupted chain of my reflections till bedtime. Even then a teacher who occupied the same room with me kept me from the subject to which I longed to recur, by a prolonged effusion of small talk. How I wished sleep would silence her. It seemed as if, could I but go back to the idea which had last entered my mind as I stood at the window, some inventive suggestion would rise for my relief. Miss Grice snored at last. She was a heavy Welsh woman. Until now her habitual nasal strains had never been regarded by me in any other light than as a nuisance. Tonight I hailed the first deep notes with satisfaction. I was debarrassed of interruption. My half-effaced thought instantly revived. A new servitude. There is something in that, I soliloquized. Mentally, be it understood, I did not talk aloud. I know there is, because it does not sound too sweet. It is not like such words as liberty, excitement, enjoyment. Delightful sounds, truly. But no more than sounds for me. And so hollow and fleeting that it is mere waste of time to listen to them. But servitude, that must be matter of fact. Anyone may serve. I have served here 8 years. Now all I want is to serve elsewhere. Can I not get so much of my own will? Is not the thing feasible? Yes. Yes, the end is not so difficult. If I had only a brain active enough to ferret out the means of attaining it. I sat up in bed by way of arousing this said brain. It was a chilly night. I covered my shoulders with a shawl, and then I proceeded to think again with all my might. What do I want? A new place? In a new house? Amongst new faces? Under new circumstances? I want this because it is of no use wanting anything better. How do people do to get a new place? They apply to friends, I suppose. I have no friends. There are many others who have no friends, who must look about for themselves and be their own helpers. And what is their resource? I could not tell. Nothing answered me. I then ordered my brain to find a response, and quickly. It worked, and worked faster. I felt the pulses throb in my head and temples. But for nearly an hour it worked in chaos, and no result came of its efforts. Feverish with vain labour, I got up and took a turn in the room. Undrew the curtain, noted a star or two, shivered with cold, and again crept to bed. A kind fairy, in my absence, had surely dropped the required suggestion on my pillow. For as I lay down, it came quietly and naturally to my mind. Those who want situations advertise. You must advertise in the Herald. How? I know nothing about advertising. Replies rose smooth and prompt now. You must enclose the advertisement and the money to pay for it under a cover directed to the editor of the Herald. You must put it, the first opportunity you have, into the post at Lowton. Answers must be addressed to J.E. at the post office there. You can go and inquire in about a week after you send your letter, if any are come, and act accordingly. The scheme I went over twice, thrice. It was then digested in my mind. I had it in a clear, practical form. I felt satisfied and fell asleep. With earliest day, I was up. I had my advertisement written, enclosed, and directed before the bell rang to rouse the school. It ran thus. A young lady accustomed to tuition, had I not been a teacher 2 years, is desirous of meeting with a situation in a private family where the children are under 14. I thought that as I was barely 18, it would not do to undertake the guidance of pupils nearer my own age. She is qualified to teach the usual branches of a good English education, together with French, drawing, and music. In those days, reader, this now narrow catalogue of accomplishments would have been held tolerably comprehensive. Address, J.E., Post Office, Lowton. This document remained locked in my drawer all day. After tea, I asked leave of the new superintendent to go to Lowton in order to perform some small commissions for myself and one or two of my fellow teachers. Permission was readily granted. I went. It was a walk of 2 miles, and the evening was wet, but the days were still long. I visited a shop or two, slipped the letter into the post office, and came back through heavy rain, with streaming garments, but with a relieved heart. The succeeding week seemed long. It came to an end at last, however, like all sublunary things, and once more, towards the close of a pleasant autumn day, I found myself afoot on the road to Lowton. A picturesque track it was, by the way, lying along the side of the beck and through the sweetest curves of the dale. But that day I thought more of the letters that might or might not be awaiting me at the little burr whither I was bound than of the charms of Lee and water. My ostensible errand on this occasion was to get measured for a pair of shoes. So I discharged that business first, and when it was done, I stepped across the clean and quiet little street from the shoemaker's to the post office. It was kept by an old dame, who wore horn spectacles on her nose and black mittens on her hands. "Are there any letters for J.E.?" I asked. She peered at me over her spectacles, and then she opened a drawer and fumbled among its contents for a long time, so long that my hopes began to falter. At last, having held the document before her glasses for nearly 5 minutes, she presented it across the counter, accompanying the act by another inquisitive and mistrustful glance. It was for J.E. "Is there only one?" I demanded.
"There are no more,"
said she, and I put it in my pocket and turned my face homeward. I could not open it then. Rules obliged me to be back by 8, and it was already 7:30. Various duties awaited me on my arrival. I had to sit with the girls during their hour of study. Then it was my turn to read prayers, to see them to bed. Afterwards I supped with the other teachers. Even when we finally retired for the night, the inevitable Miss Grice was still my companion. We had only a short end of candle in our candlestick, and I dreaded lest she should talk till it was all burnt out. Fortunately, however, the heavy supper she had eaten produced a soporific effect. She was already snoring before I had finished undressing. There still remained an inch of candle. I now took out my letter. The seal was an initial F. I broke it. The contents were brief. "If J.E., who advertised in the Shire Herald of last Thursday, possesses the acquirements mentioned, and if she is in a position to give satisfactory references as to character and competency, a situation can be offered her where there is but one pupil, a little girl under 10 years of age, and where the salary is £30 per annum. J.E. is requested to send references, name, address, and all particulars to the direction, Mrs. Fairfax, Thornfield, near Milcote." I examined the document long. The writing was old-fashioned and rather uncertain, like that of an elderly lady. This circumstance was satisfactory. A private fear had haunted me, that in thus acting for myself and by my own guidance I ran the risk of getting into some scrape. and above all things I wish the result of my endeavours to be respectable, proper, en règle. I now felt that an elderly lady was no bad ingredient in the business I had on hand. Mrs. Fairfax. I saw her in a black gown and a widow's cap. Frigid, perhaps, but not uncivil. A model of elderly English respectability. Thornfield. That, doubtless, was the name of her house. A neat, orderly spot, I was sure, though I failed in my efforts to conceive a correct plan of the premises. Milcott, I brushed up my recollections of the map of England. Yes, I saw it. Both the shire and the town. 70 miles nearer London than the remote county where I now resided. That was a recommendation to me. I longed to go where there was life and movement. Milcott was a large manufacturing town on the banks of the A. A busy place enough, doubtless. So much the better. It would be a complete change, at least. Not that my fancy was much captivated by the idea of long chimneys and clouds of smoke, but, I argued, Thornfield will, probably, be a good way from the town. Here the socket of the candle dropped, and the wick went out. Next day new steps were to be taken. My plans could no longer be confined to my own breast. I must impart them in order to achieve their success. Having sought and obtained an audience of the superintendent during the noontide recreation, I told her I had a prospect of getting a new situation where the salary would be double what I now received, for at Lowood I only got £15 per annum, and requested she would break the matter for me to Mr. Brocklehurst or some of the committee, and ascertain whether they would permit me to mention them as references. She obligingly consented to act as a mediatrix in the matter. The next day she laid the affair before Mr. Brocklehurst, who said that Mrs. Reed must be written to, as she was my natural guardian. A note was accordingly addressed to that lady, who returned for answer that, I might do as I pleased, she had long relinquished all interference in my affairs. This note went the round of the committee, and at last, after what appeared to me most tedious delay, formal leave was given me to better my condition if I could, and an assurance added that, as I had always conducted myself well, both as teacher and pupil at Lowood, a testimonial of character and capacity, signed by the inspectors of that institution, should forthwith be furnished me. This testimonial I accordingly received in about a month, forwarded a copy of it to Mrs. Fairfax, and got that lady's reply stating that she was satisfied, and fixing that day fortnight as the period for my assuming the post of governess in her house. I now busied myself in preparations. The fortnight passed rapidly. I had not a very large wardrobe, though it was adequate to my wants, and the last day sufficed to pack my trunk, the same I had brought with me 8 years ago from Gateshead. The box was corded, the card nailed on. In half an hour the carrier was to call for it to take it to Lowton, whither I myself was to repair at an early hour the next morning to meet the coach. I had brushed my black stuff-travelling dress, prepared my bonnet, gloves and muff, sought in all my drawers to see that no article was left behind. And now, having nothing more to do, I sat down and tried to rest. I could not. Though I had been on foot all day, I could not now repose an instant. I was too much excited. A phase of my life was closing tonight. A new one opening tomorrow. Impossible to slumber in the interval. I must watch feverishly while the change was being accomplished.
Miss, said a servant who met me in the lobby, where I was wandering like a troubled spirit. A person below wishes to see you.
The carrier, no doubt, I thought, and ran downstairs without inquiry. I was passing the back parlour or teacher's sitting room, the door of which was half open, to go to the kitchen, when someone ran out.
It's her, I am sure. I could have told her anywhere,
cried the individual, who stopped my progress and took my hand. I looked. I saw a woman attired like a well-dressed servant, matronly, yet still young, very good-looking, with black hair and eyes and lively complexion.
"Well, who is it?"
she asked in a voice and with a smile I half recognised.
"You've not quite forgotten me, I think, Miss Jane."
In another second I was embracing and kissing her rapturously. "Bessie! Bessie! Bessie!" That was all I said. Whereat she half laughed, half cried, and we both went into the parlour. By the fire stood a little fellow of 3 years old, in plaid frock and trousers.
"That is my little boy," said Bessie directly.
"Then you are married, Bessie?"
"Yes, nearly 5 years since to Robert Weaven, the coachman. And I've a little girl besides Bobby there, that I've christened Jane.
And you don't live at Gateshead?
I live at the lodge. The old porter has left.
Well, and how do they all get on? Tell me everything about them, Bessie, but sit down first. And Bobby, come and sit on my knee, will you? But Bobby preferred sidling over to his mother.
You're not grown so very tall, Miss Jane, nor so very stout, continued Mrs. Leaven. I dare say they've not kept you too well at school. Miss Reed is the head and shoulders taller than you are, and Miss Georgiana would make two of you in breadth.
Georgiana is handsome, I suppose, Bessie?
Very. She went up to London last winter with her mamma, and there everybody admired her, and a young lord fell in love with her. But his relations were against the match, and what do you think? He and Miss Georgiana made it up to run away, but they were found out and stopped. It was Miss Reed that found them out. I believe she was envious, and now she and her sister lead a cat-and-dog life together. They're always quarrelling.
Well, and what of John Reed?
Oh, he is not doing so well as his mamma could wish. He went to college, and he got plucked, I think they call it, and then his uncles wanted him to be a barrister and study the law, but he is such a dissipated young man. They will never make much of him, I think.
What does he look like?
He is very tall. Some people call him a fine-looking young man. He has such thick lips.
And Mrs. Reed?
Mrs. looks stout and well enough in the face, but I think she's not quite easy in her mind. Mr. John's conduct does not please her. He spends a deal of money.
Did she send you here, Bessie?
No, indeed. But I have long wanted to see you. And when I heard that there had been a letter from you, and that you were going to another part of the country, I thought I'd just set off and get a look at you before you were quite out of my reach.
I am afraid you are disappointed in me, Bessie. I said this laughing. I perceived that Bessie's glance, though it expressed regard, did in no shape denote admiration.
No, Miss Jane, not exactly. You are genteel enough. You look like a lady, and it is as much as ever I expected of you. You were no beauty as a child.
I smiled at Bessie's frank answer. I felt that it was correct, but I confess I was not quite indifferent to its import. At 18 most people wish to please, and the conviction that they have not an exterior likely to second that desire brings anything but gratification.
I dare say you are clever, though, continued Bessie, by way of solace. What can you do? Can you play on the piano?
A little.
There was one in the room. Bessie went and opened it, and then asked me to sit down and give her a tune. I played a waltz or two, and she was charmed.
The Miss Reeds could not play as well, she said exultingly. I always said you would surpass them in learning. And can you draw?
That is one of my paintings over the chimney-piece. It was a landscape in watercolours, of which I had made a present to the superintendent, in acknowledgement of her obliging mediation with a committee on my behalf, and which she had framed and glazed.
Well, that is beautiful, Miss Jane. It is as fine a picture as any Miss Reed's drawing master could paint, let alone the young ladies themselves, who could not come near it. And have you learnt French?
Yes, Bessie, I can both read it and speak it.
And you can work on muslin and canvas?
I can.
Oh, you are quite a lady, Miss Jane. I knew you would be. You will get on whether your relations notice you or not. There was something I wanted to ask you. Have you ever heard anything from your father's kinsfolk, the heirs?
Never in my life.
Well, you know Mrs. always said they were poor and quite despicable. They may be poor, but I believe they are as much gentry as the Reeds are. For one day, nearly 7 years ago, a Mr. Eyre came to Gateshead and wanted to see you. Mrs. said you were at school 50 miles off. He seemed so much disappointed, for he could not stay. He was going on a voyage to a foreign country, and the ship was to sail from London in a day or two. He looked quite a gentleman, and I believe he was your father's brother.
What foreign country was he going to, Bessie?
An island thousands of miles off, where they make wine. Oh, the butler did tell me.
Madeira, I suggested.
Yes, that is it. That is the very word.
So he went?
Yes. He did not stay many minutes in the house. Mrs. was very high with him. She called him afterwards a sneaking tradesman. My Robert believes he was a wine merchant.
Very likely, I returned. Or perhaps clerk or agent to a wine merchant.
Bessie and I conversed about old times an hour longer, and then she was obliged to leave me. I saw her again for a few minutes the next morning at Lowton, while I was waiting for the coach. We parted finally at the door of the Brocklehurst Arms there. Each went her separate way. She set off for the brow of Lowood Fell to meet the conveyance which was to take her back to Gateshead. I mounted the vehicle which was to bear me to new duties and a new life in the unknown environs of Millcote. Chapter 11. A new chapter in a novel is something like a new scene in a play, and when I draw up the curtain this time, reader, you must fancy you see a room in the George Inn at Millcote, with such large figured papering on the walls as inn-rooms have, such a carpet, such furniture, such ornaments on the mantelpiece, such prints, including a portrait of George III, and another of the Prince of Wales, and a representation of the death of Wolfe. All this is visible to you by the light of an oil lamp hanging from the ceiling, and by that of an excellent fire, near which I sit in my cloak and bonnet. My muff and umbrella lie on the table, and I am warming away the numbness and chill contracted by 16 hours' exposure to the rawness of an October day. I left Lowton at 4 o'clock a.m., and the Millcote town clock is now just striking 8. Reader, though I look comfortably accommodated, I am not very tranquil in my mind. I thought when the coach stopped here there would be someone to meet me. I looked anxiously round as I descended the wooden steps the boots placed for my convenience, expecting to hear my name pronounced, and to see some description of carriage waiting to convey me to Thornfield. Nothing of the sort was visible. And when I asked a waiter if anyone had been to inquire after a Miss Eyre, I was answered in the negative. So I had no resource but to request to be shown into a private room. And here I am waiting, while all sorts of doubts and fears are troubling my thoughts. It is a very strange sensation to an experienced youth to feel itself quite alone in the world, cut adrift from every connection, uncertain whether the port to which it is bound can be reached, and prevented by many impediments from returning to that it has quitted. The charm of adventure sweetens that sensation, the glow of pride warms it, but then the throb of fear disturbs it, and fear with me became predominant when half an hour elapsed and still I was alone. I bethought myself to ring the bell. "Is there a place in this neighbourhood called Thornfield?" I asked of the waiter who answered the summons.
"Thornfield? I don't know, ma'am. I'll inquire at the bar."
He vanished, but reappeared instantly.
"Is your name Eyre, miss?"
"Yes."
"Person here waiting for you."
I jumped up, took my muff and umbrella, and hastened into the inn passage. A man was standing by the open door, and in the lamplit street I dimly saw a one-horse conveyance.
"This will be your luggage, I suppose,"
said the man rather abruptly when he saw me, pointing to my trunk in the passage. "Yes." He hoisted it onto the vehicle, which was a sort of car, and then I got in. Before he shut me up, I asked him how far it was to Thornfield.
"Matter of 6 miles.
"How long shall we be before we get there?"
"Happen an hour and a half."
He fastened the car door, climbed to his own seat outside, and we set off. Our progress was leisurely, and gave me ample time to reflect. I was content to be at length so near the end of my journey, and as I leaned back in the comfortable though not elegant conveyance, I meditated much at my ease. "I suppose," thought I, "judging from the plainness of the servant and carriage, Mrs. Fairfax is not a very dashing person. So much the better. I never lived amongst fine people but once, and I was very miserable with them. I wonder if she lives alone except this little girl. If so, and if she is in any degree amiable, I shall surely be able to get on with her. I will do my best. It is a pity that doing one's best does not always answer. At Lowood, indeed, I took that resolution, kept it, and succeeded in pleasing. But with Mrs. Reed, I remember my best was always spurned with scorn. I pray God Mrs. Fairfax may not turn out a second Mrs. Reed. But if she does, I am not bound to stay with her. Let the worst come to the worst. I can advertise again. How far are we on our road now, I wonder?" I let down the window and looked out. Millcote was behind us. Judging by the number of its lights, it seemed a place of considerable magnitude, much larger than Lowton. We were now, as far as I could see, on a sort of common, but there were houses scattered all over the district. I felt we were in a different region to Lowood, more populous, less picturesque,
more stirring, less romantic. The roads were heavy, the night misty. My conductor let his horse walk all the way, and the hour and a half extended, I verily believe, to 2 hours. At last he turned in his seat and said,
"You're not so far from Thornfield now."
Again I looked out. We were passing a church. I saw its low, broad tower against the sky, and its bell was tolling a quarter. I saw a narrow galaxy of lights, too, on a hillside, marking a village or hamlet. About 10 minutes after, the driver got down and opened a pair of gates. We passed through, and they clashed behind us. We now slowly ascended a drive, and came upon the long front of a house. Candlelight gleamed from one curtained bow window. All the rest were dark. The car stopped at the front door. It was opened by a maidservant. I alighted and went in.
"Will you walk this way, ma'am?"
said the girl, and I followed her across a square hall with high doors all round. She ushered me into a room whose double illumination of fire and candle at first dazzled me, contrasting as it did with the darkness to which my eyes had been for 2 hours inured. When I could see, however, a cosy and agreeable picture presented itself to my view. A snug small room, a round table by a cheerful fire, an armchair high-backed and old-fashioned, wherein sat the neatest imaginable little elderly lady, in widow's cap, black silk gown, and snowy muslin apron. Exactly like what I had fancied Mrs. Fairfax, only less stately and milder-looking. She was occupied in knitting. A large cat sat demurely at her feet. Nothing, in short, was wanting to complete the beau ideal of domestic comfort. A more reassuring introduction for a new governess could scarcely be conceived. There was no grandeur to overwhelm, no stateliness to embarrass. And then, as I entered, the old lady got up and promptly and kindly came forward to meet me.
"How do you do, my dear? I am afraid you have had a tedious ride. John drives so slowly. You must be cold. Come to the fire."
"Mrs. Fairfax, I suppose," said I.
"Yes, you are right. Do sit down."
She conducted me to her own chair, and then began to remove my shawl and untie my bonnet strings. I begged she would not give herself so much trouble.
"Oh, it's no trouble. I dare say your own hands are almost numb with cold. Wait, make a little hot negus and cut a sandwich or two. Here are the keys of the storeroom."
And she produced from her pocket a most housewifely bunch of keys, and delivered them to the servant.
"Now then, draw nearer to the fire," she continued. "You brought your luggage with you, haven't you, my dear?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"I'll see it carried into your room,"
she said, and bustled out. "She treats me like a visitor," thought I. I little expected such a reception. I anticipated only coldness and stiffness. This is not like what I have heard of the treatment of governesses, but I must not exult too soon. She returned, with her own hands cleared her knitting apparatus and a book or two from the table, to make room for the tray which Leah now brought, and then herself handed me the refreshments. I felt rather confused at being the object of more attention than I had ever before received, and that, too, shown by my employer and superior. But as she did not herself seem to consider she was doing anything out of her place, I thought it better to take her civilities quietly. "Shall I have the pleasure of seeing Miss Fairfax tonight?" I asked, when I had partaken of what she offered me.
"What did you say, my dear?" "I am a little deaf,"
returned the good lady, approaching her ear to my mouth. I repeated the question more distinctly.
"Miss Fairfax? Oh, you mean Miss Varens. Varens is the name of your future pupil."
"Indeed? Then she is not your daughter?"
"No, I have no family."
I should have followed up my first inquiry by asking in what way Miss Varon was connected with her, but I recollected it was not polite to ask too many questions. Besides, I was sure to hear in time.
"I'm so glad," she continued, as she sat down opposite to me and took the cat on her knee. "I'm so glad you are come. It'll be quite pleasant living here now with a companion. To be sure, it is pleasant at any time, for Thornfield is a fine old hall, rather neglected of late years, perhaps. But still it is a respectable place. Yet, you know, in winter time one feels dreary quite alone in the best quarters. I say alone. Lee is a nice girl, to be sure. And John and his wife are very decent people. But then, you see, they're only servants, and one can't converse with them on terms of equality.
One must keep them at due distance for fear of losing one's authority. I'm sure last winter, it was a very severe one if you recollect, and when it did not snow, it rained and blew. Not a creature but the butcher and postman came to the house from November till February, and I really got quite melancholy with sitting night after night alone. I had Leering to read to me sometimes, but I don't think the poor girl liked the task much. She felt it confining. In spring and summer one got on better. Sunshine and long days make such a difference. And then, just at the commencement of this autumn, little Adela Veron came and her nurse. The child makes the house alive all at once. And now you are here, I shall be quite gay.
My heart really warmed to the worthy lady as I heard her talk, and I drew my chair a little nearer to her, and expressed my sincere wish that she might find my company as agreeable as she anticipated.
"But I'll not keep you sitting up late tonight," said she. "It is on the stroke of 12 now, and you've been travelling all day, you must feel tired. If you have got your feet well warmed, I'll show you your bedroom. I've had the room next to mine prepared for you. It is only a small apartment, but I thought you would like it better than one of the large front chambers. To be sure, they have finer furniture, but they're so dreary and solitary, I never sleep in them myself."
I thanked her for her considerate choice, and as I really felt fatigued with my long journey, expressed my readiness to retire. She took her candle, and I followed her from the room. First she went to see if the hall door was fastened. Having taken the key from the lock, she led the way upstairs. The steps and banisters were of oak. The staircase window was high and latticed. Both it and the long gallery into which the bedroom doors opened looked as if they belonged to a church rather than a house. A very chill and vault-like air pervaded the stairs and gallery, suggesting cheerless ideas of space and solitude. And I was glad, when finally ushered into my chamber, to find it of small dimensions and furnished in ordinary, modern style. When Mrs. Fairfax had bidden me a kind good night, and I had fastened my door, gazed leisurely around, and in some measure effaced the eerie impression made by that wide hall, that dark and spacious staircase, and that long, cold gallery, by the livelier aspect of my little room, I remembered that, after a day of bodily fatigue and mental anxiety, I was now at last in safe haven. The impulse of gratitude swelled my heart, and I knelt down at the bedside and offered up thanks where thanks were due, not forgetting, ere I rose, to implore aid on my further path, and the power of meriting the kindness which seemed so frankly offered me before it was earned. My couch had no thorns in it that night, my solitary room no fears. At once weary and content, I slept soon and soundly. When I awoke, it was broad day. The chamber looked such a bright little place to me as the sun shone in between the gay blue chintz window curtains, showing papered walls and a carpeted floor so unlike the bare planks and stained plaster of Lowood that my spirits rose at the view. Externals have a great effect on the young. I thought that a fairer era of life was beginning for me, one that was to have its flowers and pleasures, as well as its thorns and toils. My faculties, roused by the change of scene, the new field offered to hope, seemed all astir. I cannot precisely define what they expected, but it was something pleasant. Not perhaps that day or that month, but at an indefinite future period. I rose. I dressed myself with care, obliged to be plain, for I had no article of attire that was not made with extreme simplicity. I was still by nature solicitous to be neat. It was not my habit to be disregardful of appearance or careless of the impression I made. On the contrary, I ever wished to look as well as I could, and to please as much as my want of beauty would permit. I sometimes regretted that I was not handsomer. I sometimes wished to have rosy cheeks, a straight nose, and small cherry mouth. I desired to be tall, stately, and finely developed in figure. I felt it a misfortune that I was so little, so pale, and had features so irregular and so marked. And why had I these aspirations and these regrets? It would be difficult to say. I could not then distinctly say it to myself. Yet I had a reason, and a logical, natural reason, too. However, when I had brushed my hair very smooth, and put on my black frock, which, Quaker-like as it was, at least had the merit of fitting to a nicety, and adjusted my clean white tucker, I thought I should do respectably enough to appear before Mrs. Fairfax, and that my new pupil would not at least recoil from me with antipathy. Having opened my chamber window, and seen that I left all things straight and neat on the toilet table, I ventured forth. Traversing the long and matted gallery, I descended the slippery steps of oak. Then I gained the hall. I halted there a minute. I looked at some pictures on the walls. One I remember represented a grim man in a cuirass, and one a lady with powdered hair and a pearl necklace. At a bronze lamp pendant from the ceiling. At a great clock whose case was of oak curiously carved. And ebon black with time and rubbing. Everything appeared very stately and imposing to me, but then I was so little accustomed to grandeur. The hall door, which was half of glass, stood open. I stepped over the threshold. It was a fine autumn morning. The early sun shone serenely on embrowned groves and still green fields. Advancing onto the lawn, I looked up and surveyed the front of the mansion. It was 3 stories high, of proportions not vast, though considerable. A gentleman's manor house, not a nobleman's seat. Battlements round the top gave it a picturesque look. Its grey front stood out well from the background of a rookery, whose cawing tenants were now on the wing. They flew over the lawn and grounds to alight in a great meadow, from which these were separated by a sunk fence, and where an array of mighty old thorn trees, strong, knotty, and broad as oaks, at once explained the etymology of the mansion's designation. Farther off were hills, not so lofty as those round Lowood, nor so craggy, nor so like barriers of separation from the living world, but yet quiet and lonely hills enough, and seeming to embrace Thornfield with a seclusion I had not expected to find existent so near the stirring locality of Millcote. A little hamlet, whose roofs were blent with trees, straggled up the side of one of these hills. The church of the district stood nearer Thornfield. Its old tower top looked over a knoll between the house and gates. I was yet enjoying the calm prospect and pleasant fresh air, yet listening with delight to the cawing of the rooks, yet surveying the wide, hoary front of the hall, and thinking what a great place it was for one lonely little dame like Mrs. Fairfax to inhabit, when that lady appeared at the door.
"What, out already?"
said she. "I see you're an early riser."
I went up to her and was received with an affable kiss and shake of the hand.
"How do you like Thornfield?"
she asked. I told her I liked it very much.
"Yes," she said, "it is a pretty place, but I fear it will be getting out of order unless Mr. Rochester should take it into his head to come and reside here permanently, or, at least, visit it rather oftener. Great houses and fine grounds require the presence of the proprietor."
"Mr. Rochester," I exclaimed. "Who is he?"
"The owner of Thornfield," she responded quietly. "Did you not know he was called Rochester?"
Of course I did not. I had never heard of him before. But the old lady seemed to regard his existence as a universally understood fact, with which everybody must be acquainted by instinct. "I thought," I continued, "Thornfield belonged to you."
"To me? Bless you, child! What an idea! To me? I am only the housekeeper, the manager. To be sure, I am distantly related to the Rochesters by the mother's side, or at least my husband was. He was a clergyman, incumbent of Hay, that little village yonder on the hill. And that church near the gates was his. The present Mr. Rochester's mother was a Fairfax, and second cousin to my husband, but I never presume on the connection. In fact, it is nothing to me. I consider myself quite in the light of an ordinary housekeeper. My employer is always civil, and I expect nothing more."
"And the little girl, my pupil?"
"She is Mr. Rochester's ward. He commissioned me to find a governess for her. He intended to have her brought up in Shire, I believe. Here she comes, with her bonne, as she called a nurse."
The enigma then was explained. This affable and kind little widow was no great dame, but a dependent like myself. I did not like her the worse for that. On the contrary, I felt better pleased than ever. The equality between her and me was real, not the mere result of condescension on her part. So much the better. My position was all the freer. As I was meditating on this discovery, a little girl, followed by her attendant, came running up the lawn. I looked at my pupil, who did not at first appear to notice me. She was quite a child, perhaps 7 or 8 years old, slightly built, with a pale, small-featured face, and a redundancy of hair falling in curls to her waist.
"Good morning, Miss Adela," said Mrs. Fairfax. "Come and speak to the lady who is to teach you, and to make you a clever woman some day."
She approached.
"C'est la ma gouvernante,"
said she, pointing to me, and addressing her nurse, who answered,
"Mais oui, certainement."
"Are they foreigners?" I inquired, amazed at hearing the French language.
The nurse is a foreigner, and Adela was born on the continent, and I believe never left it till within 6 months ago. When she first came here, she could speak no English. Now she can make shift to talk it a little. I don't understand her. She mixes it so with French. But you will make out her meaning very well, I dare say.
Fortunately, I had had the advantage of being taught French by a French lady, and as I had always made a point of conversing with Madame Perrault as often as I could, and had besides, during the last 7 years, learnt a portion of French by heart daily. Applying myself to take pains with my accent, and imitating as closely as possible the pronunciation of my teacher, I had acquired a certain degree of readiness and correctness in the language, and was not likely to be much at a loss with Mademoiselle Adela. She came and shook hand with me when she heard that I was her governess, and as I led her into breakfast, I addressed some phrases to her in her own tongue. She replied briefly at first, but after we were seated at the table, and she had examined me some 10 minutes with her large hazel eyes, she suddenly commenced chattering fluently.
"Ah!" cried she, in French. "You speak my language as well as Mr. Rochester does. I can talk to you as I can to him, and so can Sophie. She'll be glad. Nobody here understands her. Madame Fairfax is all English. Sophie is my nurse. She came with me over the sea in a great ship with a chimney that smoked. How it did smoke! And I was sick, and so was Sophie, and so was Mr. Rochester. Mr. Rochester lay down on a sofa in a pretty room called the salon, and Sophie and I had little beds in another place. I nearly fell out of mine. It was like a shelf. And mademoiselle, what is your name?
Eyre. Jane Eyre.
Eyre? Bah! I cannot say it. Well, our ship stopped in the morning, before it was quite daylight, at a great city, a huge city, with very dark houses and all smoky, not at all like the pretty clean town I came from. And Mr. Rochester carried me in his arms over a plank to the land, and Sophie came after, and we all got into a coach, which took us to a beautiful large house, larger than this and finer, called an hotel. We stayed there nearly a week. I and Sophie used to walk every day in a great green place full of trees, called the park, and there were many children there besides me, and a pond with beautiful birds in it, that I fed with crumbs.
"Can you understand her when she runs on so fast?" asked Mrs. Fairfax.
I understood her very well, for I had been accustomed to the fluent tongue of Madame Perrault.
"I wish," continued the good lady, "you would ask her a question or two about her parents. Wonder if she remembers them."
"Adele?" I inquired. "With whom did you live when you were in that pretty clean town you spoke of?"
"I lived long ago with Mama, but she is gone to the Holy Virgin. Mama used to teach me to dance and sing and to say verses. A great many gentlemen and ladies came to see Mama, and I used to dance before them, or to sit on their knees and sing to them. I liked it. Shall I let you hear me sing now?"
She had finished her breakfast, so I permitted her to give a specimen of her accomplishments. Descending from her chair, she came and placed herself on my knee. Then, folding her little hands demurely before her, shaking back her curls and lifting her eyes to the ceiling, she commenced singing a song from some opera. It was the strain of a forsaken lady who, after bewailing the perfidy of her lover, calls pride to her aid, desires her attendant to deck her in her brightest jewels and richest robes, and resolves to meet the false one that night at a ball, and prove to him, by the gaiety of her demeanour, how little his desertion has affected her. The subject seemed strangely chosen for an infant singer, but I suppose the point of the exhibition lay in hearing the notes of love and jealousy warbled with the lisp of childhood, and in very bad taste that point was. At least I thought so. Adele sang the canzonet tunefully enough, and with the naivete of her age. This achieved, she jumped from my knee and said,
"Now, mademoiselle, I will repeat you some poetry."
Assuming an attitude, she began. La Ligue des Rats, Fable de la Fontaine. She then declaimed the little piece with an attention to punctuation and emphasis, a flexibility of voice and an appropriateness of gesture, very unusual indeed at her age, and which proved she had been carefully trained. "Was it your mamma who taught you that piece?" I asked.
"Yes, and she just used to say it in this way. Qu'avez-vous donc? Lui dit un de ses rats. Parlez. She made me lift my hand, so, to remind me to raise my voice at the question. Now, shall I dance for you?
No, that will do. But after your mama went to the Holy Virgin, as you say,